Chapter 8. So much for my theory about fairy tales. We were being watched constantly through divination, and Grognuail was the antenna. What Odin could do, others could do just as well, so Odin's point that there were other interested parties was well taken. The reason we had a vampire and dark elves waiting for us near the Slovakian border was because someone in Tir na n'Og was coolly divining Grognuail's location, quite correctly assuming I'd be nearby, and then dispatching assorted evil minions to slay us. They'd done this repeatedly in Greece while we were trying to get Grognuail bound to the earth. We'd shaken them for a while in the French Pyrenees, perhaps because we were spending nights inside a mountain and the scryer could not figure out where we were, but eventually they must have zeroed in on us. We'd left just ahead of an oncoming horde of vampires, if Oberon's nose could be trusted, and it usually could. After we raided Hel and killed Fenris, Grognuail and I had been left alone in Mexico for a couple of blissful weeks. Why was that? I'm sure her presence there would have been as easy to divine as anywhere else, and I was most certainly very close to her during that time. It must have been because the puppet master, whoever it was, couldn't get minions out to us in Mexico. If that was correct, then that told me quite a bit. I had bound Mexico to Tir na n'Og long ago, back when the Maya were still running around and building future tourist sites. The Fae could have shifted and found us in short order if they wished. And Mexico certainly had its share of vampires. If they had wanted to find us, there would be no reason for it to take 2 days to locate us, much less 2 weeks. So this mysterious person was not using local vampires and wasn't shifting minions around using tethered trees. Instead, he or she was using a specific set of vampires, perhaps a specific set of Fae and Dark Elves too, and shifting them around using the old ways in Europe. That meant Mexico was safe territory. The whole New World was safe territory. And now that I knew that, Faunus had made sure that safe territory was unreachable. It also meant that there was something important about the old ways that I was missing. Hey, Oberon!
Hey, Atticus!
Ask Grognuail if she's willing to investigate one of the old ways in Germany and see if we can escape through one.
Escaping would be good.
A few moments passed, and then Oberon said,
Clever girl reminds you, De Morgan said they were all collapsed or guarded.
Most likely that's true. I'm actually more interested in finding out who's guarding them. This is recon more than a genuine attempt to escape.
I've been meaning to tell you that when I chew on things, it's recon more than a genuine attempt to destroy your stuff.
Just tell her, please.
Okay, she says let's do it.
Follow me. Eastern Germany had an old way to Tir na n'Og. Several, in fact, hidden among the river valleys of the Ore Mountains, which divided Saxony from Bohemia. But the nearest was a wee bit southwest of the city of Hoyerswerda, in Dubringer Moor, a wetland populated around the edges with birch, pine, and alder, spreading their roots in its marshy soil. Unlike the vast majority of the old ways, it wasn't in a cave. A few, like this one, were open-air mazes without walls. Walk through the birches in a certain pattern, end at a particular alder tree, and circle it thrice, and you'd be in Tir na n'Og. It wasn't the sort of old way that you could collapse with an earthquake. You could clear-cut the trees or set fire to the landscape, and perhaps we would find something like that had happened, but it was more likely to be guarded. Or not. How do you guard a place that's open to the air, and open to the public, without generating some attention? With caves, you can hide the guardians inside. We had to turn due south to get to Dubringer Moor, skirting a huge lignite strip mine at Kausch, but otherwise enjoying the mixed evergreen and deciduous forests that surrounded wee hamlets, until we arrived at the moor. Trees grew out of some juicy ground around the edges of it, but near the center it was a swampy marshland. I stopped at a birch tree that had three knots reminiscent of a triskele on one side. After looking around to make sure we were unobserved, I shifted to human and drew Fragorov from its scabbard. Ready? I asked. Grognuail shapeshifted and held Skawaja at the ready.
Yep. Go.
In the magical spectrum, the old way was plain to see, But Oberon couldn't see it at all, and I didn't want him to step off. We'll go slow. Look and listen for guardians. Don't forget the treetops. And Oberon, if you smell anything weird, let us know.
Okay.
And stay close to us. Single file. No chasing squirrels or anything else.
Ah!
We advance 10 paces to another birch, directly south of the first one. Walk around this counterclockwise, I said, demonstrating, and then we go west. They followed me to the tree next door, and then we turned south. Oberon asked,
Can I go smell that bush over there?
No, you can't, buddy. I'm sorry. The path itself is the tether to Tir na n'Og. It can be walked both ways. If a tree dies, then the path gets adjusted a tiny bit, but it essentially remains the same. The alder tree at the end of this must be the 20th different tree anchoring this old way since I learned about it. And the same goes for the birch where we began. But if you step off the path, you have to start over. We crept through the birches, following a sinuous trail and stopping periodically to listen and watch for trouble. Nothing alarmed us, aside from the paranoia that every step brought. We kept expecting fairies or some sort of monster from Greco-Roman myth to jump on us, but we had this portion of the moor to ourselves. When we reached the alder tree, I grew super cautious, peering up into the canopy.
There has to be something here, I said. It can't be that easy.
What's easy?
This is it, right here. We walk around that tree 3 times and we're in Tir na n'Og. Boom, escaped. We shift to the New World and send all these ass bananas a postcard that says, Suck it, you'll never trap us again. But it doesn't make sense.
Maybe they forgot about this one,
Grognuel ventured. Maybe. Maybe they're just being clever with their ambushes. Maybe someone's invisible.
Let's check the magical spectrum.
Already there, but go ahead. You might see something I didn't. Grognuel scanned the tree and noted it had a whisper of color about it as a tether, but there wasn't anything else to be seen. Nothing glowing in the canopy, nothing glowing on the ground.
Oberon, what do you smell?
Grognuel asked. His nose twitched for a few moments before he gave a mental shrug.
You guys, swampy birchy grassy stuff. Nothing to eat.
All right, we'll just take it slow. I crept forward and led them toward the alder tree. We had to go clockwise around this one. I peered up into the branches, but spied no threats. The first orbit around the tree was uneventful, and I began to hope. But the second trip around put us halfway between the planes, and we saw what was waiting for us if we kept going. A semi-transparent second world overlaid the one we were walking. And waiting there, in Tir na n'Og, one more circle around the tree, was the guardian we'd been expecting all along. I should say, rather, that we expected a guardian, but not this particular guardian.
Eep!
Grognuel squeaked, startled. Oberon barked at it. I raised Fraggaraw and watched it carefully. It smiled at us with 3 rows of jagged teeth, but did not move except to raise its tail. The end of it was blackened and bristling with what looked like very large cactus thorns. Except for the tail and the human face with an abnormally toothy grin, it had the body of a red lion. The face was framed all around by a magnificent mane, with the lush hair growing out from the neck reminding me of 19th-century American romantic poets.
If that's what I think it is, then it's not Greco-Roman, Grognuel said, and it's not Fey either.
No, this guy would be Persian, I said, but I have no idea why he's involved in this.
What is it, Atticus? I don't like all those teeth.
It's a manticore, I said. It shouldn't be in Tir na n'Og. Oberon growled low in his throat, a steady rumble of warning.
I don't think it should be anywhere. That thing looks wrong and hungry.
Can it attack us?
Grognuel asked. I lowered my sword. Not from where it currently is.
It's right in front of us.
No, it's in Tir na n'Og, and we're not quite there yet. We'd have to go around the tree once more, and then he could attack us.
Or he could go around the tree the other way.
No, that wouldn't get him here. He can't get out of Tir na n'og without walking the proper path. It's just as complicated from that side as it is from here. We had to take many steps to get this far, and he would have to take as many to get to us. And I bet you he doesn't know the way. He can't see the path in the magical spectrum like we can. He was placed there by somebody else, and he has to wait for us to come to him.
But he's in Tir na n'og, right? So if we get past him, we're golden, correct?
Well, yes. But getting past a manticore is next to impossible. Their venom is supposed to be a death sentence. Doesn't matter if it comes out of the tail or from his bite. Even the claws are deadly, if reports are accurate.
Reports or myths?
Myths, you're right. I'm sorry. There are no reports of people surviving manticore attacks because they would have to survive to report it.
Couldn't we break down the venom ourselves by unbinding it? I mean, we're sort of immune to poison, aren't we?
I suppose we are in some sense, but that takes concentration, and while you're working on not dying from poison, he'll spill your guts on the grass or bite your head off. And the third member of our party is not immune. Oberon stopped the barrel roll of his growling.
Wait, if this is a party, where's the snack tray?
The manticore's face, a malevolent visage promising painful death, abruptly turned to one of earnest appeal. He raised a paw to beckon to us, indicating that we should come through.
Okay, that's really creepy,
Grognewell said. Yeah, it's kind of a step into my parlor kind of thing, isn't it? Well, we're not going to play his little manticore games. We have our answer now. The Morgan was right. Everything's being watched.
But it's a bit staggering. You mean all this effort to kill us?
Yeah. It could be done in a simpler fashion, but whoever's behind this wants to make sure no blame accrues to them.
I wonder what happens when this guy goes to the dentist.
Huh. Atticus, could every old way in Tir na n'og be guarded without Briet's knowledge?
I considered. Probably not for an extended period of time, but for a short while I don't see why not.
Well, I don't see why. How can she be unaware?
She has to be informed, just like a president or a prime minister does. She won't know there's a problem until somebody tells her.
Okay, so that means she could conceivably be the one behind this, or she's aware of it and complicit, or she's flat-out clueless.
Don't forget aware and incompetent. Conceivable, but doubtful.
All right. I want to talk about it some more, but let's step away from those teeth first.
You know he can't floss without tums. Think of the halitosis.
Yep, good call. We need to move on. We doubtless ceded some ground to Artemis and Diana during this little side trip, and we could ill afford to give them any more. The manticore's face melted into desperation once we began to backpedal, and then he gave up all pretense of pacifism and sprang at us, mouth agape and claws extended. It was entirely silent and phantasmal. He passed right through me, not being quite on the same plane as I was.
Ha! No druid for you!
Oberon taunted him. The manticore faded entirely from view once we stepped off the path. We agreed to resume our run and continue northwest through Germany until we safely cleared the Harz Mountains, and then we'd head straight west for the Netherlands according to the path laid out for us by the elemental Saxony. It was already somewhere around midday, and we wouldn't get out of Germany before night fell.
Can we run as humans for a while to save Oberon the effort of relaying our conversation?
Grognewell said. I shrugged. It would be slower going, but we had a bit of a lead and we needed to talk. Sure. We adopted a ground-eating pace and trusted Saxony to guide us around developed areas as much as possible. With any luck, our streaking would go unnoticed. Or, if someone did see us, they might reasonably conclude we were running away from the very large dog behind us.
So, who's in charge of the old ways on the Tir na n'og side?
Grognewell asked.
Who would inform Briet if there was a problem?
Ah, the rangers. I see where you're going with this now. If Briet isn't responsible and no one's told her what's going on, then someone has suborned the rangers.
Exactly. And remember when we first went to Tir na n'Og together, and there was that one Fey lord who told us the rangers had reported all the tree tethers were malfunctioning throughout Europe?
Yes, snooty foppish type. I called him Lord Grundlebeard.
Right, and so he's not a good buddy of yours, and he's in charge of the rangers, or he wouldn't have been reporting that at the Fey court.
Gods below, I breathed, realizing she was right.
Yeah, would Lord Grundlebeard have the power to do all this?
I thought aloud for her benefit. Use the rangers to organize some sort of obstruction at every old way throughout Europe. Yes, he could do that. But reliably divine your location the way that the Tuatha De Danann or other gods can do? That's doubtful. And consider what we've had thrown at us in the past few months. Dark elves, fey assassins, vampires, and now the Olympians. You'd have to have vast resources and serious power to push all those buttons and still keep yourself hidden. Grundlebeard can't have that kind of juice on tap.
Wait, you think this person is working with the Olympians?
Now that we're talking through it, I think they have to be. Just remember how this all went down. I was giving you a tour of the old ways. We got to a specific spot in Romania, and the trap was sprung. The Olympians were already there waiting for us, and so was the Morrigan. Now, the Olympians have their own methods of divination, and they could have figured out where to find you in advance, and, of course, it's Pan and Faunus who are spreading pandemonium and preventing us from shifting through tethered trees. But there's no way they could have set a manticore to guarding one of the old ways in Germany from the Tir na n'Og side. They have to be colluding with someone on the Fey court, but I don't think it's Lord Grundlebeard. I think he's involved, don't get me wrong, but it's more likely that he's getting his orders from someone higher up.
Okay, I won't argue with that. But the manticore tells us something else.
What?
Whoever's after us, they're spread really thin. You don't use manticores as mercenaries unless you're desperate, am I right?
That's a good point, I said. I think we should address that and other points with Lord Grundlebeard at our earliest opportunity. Find out who's giving him orders.
Agreed. Who knows what revelations would follow?
Hey, Atticus. Clever girl. I've just had a revelation.
What is it? I asked him.
I know why humans wear clothes. It's because you look ridiculous when you run naked. You both have all these floppy jiggly bits and...
Okay, that will do.
Victory is mine! Hound 1, Druid 0.
Oberon, we can't play that now.
Well, what else are we going to do? I like a good one as much as the next hound, but we have been running for a really long time. I don't get to stop and smell anything, or chase pine martens, or talk about my favorite movies, because you guys are wound up tighter than a Yorkie's back door. Can't we lighten up a bit while we run?
What do you want? The story?
Sure, a good Irish story.
All right. There's one that may be relevant to our current situation. I just thought of someone amongst the Tuatha De Danann who might have the means, motive, and opportunity to arrange all this.
Well, that doesn't sound like a story to me. It sounds like you want to obsess some more about who's after you.
Obsess? I'd call it dutiful attention to self-preservation. Come on, Oberon. It has birds behaving badly, love rectangles, and even a cameo appearance by the late not-so-great Angus Og.
That god you killed a few months ago?
That was 12 years ago, Oberon, but yes, that god.
Months, years, whatever. He was in a love rectangle?
No, Angus wasn't, but his half-brother, Mir, was. They were both sons of the Dada, and it's Mir who might be behind all this.
I haven't met him, have I?
Granuel asked. No, he was at the Fey court the day you were introduced, but he did not introduce himself. I remember seeing him seated with the Tuatha De Danann on the right side of Briat, but he didn't come up to say hi with the rest of them.
Maybe he's a little bit sure about you sending Angus to hell.
That's my theory.
Okay, lay it on me.
All right. I don't think I should tell you the whole thing. It would take too long. It's practically an epic, called Tokmark Etin, or The Wooing of Etin. These events took place before I reached my first century of life. I had already discovered the secret to immortality, thanks to Ermit, daughter of DNK, but I had yet to acquire Fragora. Ready for the short version? The version I heard from people living at the time, not the one written down by Christian monks centuries later?
Yeah, go.
Okay. Mir desired a woman who was not his wife, a beautiful woman named Etin. With Angus Oak's help, he got her, and he lived with her for a year and a day, which effectively divorced him from his first wife, Fuamna, according to the laws of the time. Fuamna disapproved of the match, as you might expect, and being no slouch at magic herself, she turned Etin into a large purple butterfly that was blown about on the wind for 7 years, until the poor lass landed on the shoulder of Angus Oak. Realizing it was Etin and that Mir was especially talented in shapeshifting others besides himself, Angus warded Etin with wild magic and tried to return her to Mir in hopes of saving her. But Fuamna again summoned winds and blew Etin away. This time, the butterfly fell into a flagon and was consumed by the wife of a warrior who'd been trying to start a family. Angus Og's wards preserved Etin's life in singular fashion. She made the leap from digestive system to womb, shifted from butterfly to egg, and was eventually reborn to this woman, still beautiful but remembering nothing of her former existence.
Whoa, Atticus, hold on. Etin was a large butterfly, and this woman didn't notice that floating in her drink? The wings and the little insect legs didn't tickle her throat on the way down?
Well, it was a big-ass wooden flagon, Oberon, not a glass brandy snifter. You don't take dainty sips out of a flagon. You gulp giant draughts at a time and let rivulets of mead flow out the sides of your mouth. If she felt anything at all, she'd probably chalk it up to something going down the wrong tube.
All right, but come on. How do you jump from stomach to womb and shift from an insect to a fertilized human egg?
That was Angus Og's wild magic ward at work. It's supposed to protect you, but its effects are unpredictable since it improvises its responses to danger. Most of the wards I craft are simply wards of repulsion, to prevent certain kinds of beings from passing, like a ring of salt can prevent the passage of spirits, but not much else. Wild magic is capable of doing most anything.
And this all really happened?
As far as I know, it's true. The details were given to me by the Morrigan and Ermit after the fact. The Morrigan heard part of it from Angus Og, and Ermit heard part of it from her father, D.N.K., whose role in this I'm kind of skipping for brevity.
Okay, what happened after she was reborn?
Years later, the High King of Ireland, Ohet Aram, had his pick of the most beautiful women in Ireland for his bride, and naturally chose to wed Etin. The Tuatha De Danann always took note when the High King took a wife, and that is how Mir learned that his old love was walking the world again. Mir still loved her, but she, of course, didn't remember him at all, so he set about wooing her in epic fashion. The story here goes on for quite some time about the love rectangle between Etin and three men. Mir, King Ohet, and Ohet's brother, Alyil. Alyil was basically a puppet in all of this, his behavior controlled by Mir and Angus Og, but he at least escaped from the whole mess with only a few months' suffering. Not so the High King. Mir performed 4 magical tasks for the High King on behalf of Ireland, and also gave away vast sums of wealth, all with the goal of winning Etin. Once he figured that she rightfully belonged to him, he showed up at court in Tara, turned both himself and Etin into swans, and flew away in full view of the monarch. King Oten searched for her for many years, tearing up the fairy mounds of the Tuatha De Danann until finally he hit upon the correct one. Mir she, called Brile. He demanded the return of Etin, and Mir eventually agreed, saying he'd bring her to Tara forthwith. He was as good as his word. He brought Etin to Tara. But he also brought 49 other women whom he had enchanted to look just like Etin. He presented the 50 women to King Oten and said, "Go ahead, dude, choose your wife." The High King chose one, and they had a kid together, and for a minute you think, "Aw, how nice, a royal successor and a happily ever after." But Mir returned after a year and a day and said, "So, King Oten, how do you like your wife?" And Oten replied that he was vastly pleased. That's when Mir crushed him forever. He said, "Did you know that Etin was pregnant when we took wing together all those years ago? She gave birth to a daughter, your daughter, though the child was never told this. and it was she whom you chose, in the likeness of her mother, to be your queen. You are now married to your own daughter, and have lain with her, and brought forth issue with her. And you have given me a teen once again. So you are paid for trifling with the Tuatha De Danann.
Ah, you didn't say it was going to be gross, Oberon said.
Yeah, Atticus, I'm with the Hound on this one, Granuel said. Turbo ooh, okay?
Why are you blaming me? I said. I didn't make it up. That is what Mir did to the High King of Ireland.
Well, if that's how it happened, I don't like how a teen was never given a choice. Both Mir and Oten should have been kicked in the marble bag for behaving like her hoo-ha was something they could buy and sell.
Should you ever meet Mir, I urge you to deliver that kick to the marble bag and tell him why, I said. But again, it's not my story. It's an illustration of Mir's character and abilities. What did you learn?
He's so powerful that he could turn you into a newt.
Well, not us. That would be a direct spell, and your cold iron talisman would protect you from that. It's not preventing people from divining your location, but it does protect against targeted magical attacks. What I hoped you'd learn is something about how Mir operates.
He's shady, Granuel said, and patient. Once he knows what he wants, he's willing to wait to get it, and will set up everything so that his victory will be assured. Not afraid to do his own dirty work, either. Though he hasn't shown himself to us yet, if he's the one behind this.
It's a different situation, I said. He can't afford to be directly involved. Remember that, until recent events, the Morrigan was very much in my corner. He had to tiptoe very carefully to make sure she wouldn't discover his involvement. And there are others among the Tuatha De Danann who are favorably disposed toward us. Govnu, for one, and Mananon MacLir, who were powerful and influential in their own right.
But wait a second, Granuel said. If he's doing all this to avenge his brother's death at your hands, shouldn't he have been destroyed years ago when Briad and the Morrigan did their purge? They went around putting people down after Angus Oak tried to take over, didn't they?
Excellent point. He must have concealed his allegiance very well.
Unless he was never allied with Angus at all. If he's Angus's half-brother, then he's Briad's too, isn't he?
Yes.
So he might have been in Briat's camp all along.
True, but if that's the case, that would still make him antagonistic to us now, since we are not Briat's favorite druids.
Speak for yourself, Granuel said. She likes me just fine.
I grinned, acknowledging that she had a point there. Either way, he's still around and could have both the means and motive to wish us harm. We need to investigate when we get the chance.
You know what I think? I think Briat's only jealous of Atticus because I'm so much smarter than her wolfhounds. And I'm more handsome by an exponential factor of shepherd's pie.
What? Oberon, that doesn't make any sense.
It makes perfect sense to me.
Do you perhaps mean pi, the mathematical symbol?
No, Atticus, I mean shepherd's pie. I'm not going to confuse that with math. Shepherd's pie is delicious and desirable, and math is not.
My efforts over the years to instruct Oberon in basic timekeeping and other mathematical concepts had failed utterly. Except in the realm of vocabulary, I suppose. He soaked that all up and spouted it out later in unpredictable combinations. He had tried, for example, to rate dry dog food on the quotient of the beef correlation coefficient, and sausage on a pork echelon matrix. But he still got confused if you asked him to count beyond 20.
Oh,
I think I see now, I said. You are using shepherd's pie as a unit of measurement.
That's right. It measures how awesome something is.
But that's math.
No, it's food. It makes perfect sense to dogs, Atticus. You're human, so you wouldn't understand.
Didn't you use gravy in this manner before?
Shepherd's pie contains a witch beef gravy, so pie is on another level than gravy, see?
I think so. This means that cold chicken, for example, would be a kind of gravy, while a slow-roasted tri-tip would be
a big slice of pie. Or, looked at another way, greyhounds are gravy, poodles are pie.
Got it. I think you're right, buddy, I said. Briat is totally jealous. Granuel and I shifted to our hoofed forms, and we picked up our pace again. Chapter 9. It was unfortunate that we had no time to savor our surroundings on such a beautiful day. The mixed woods of Germany were the sort that deserved a good savoring. No, a savoring, with a British U in there for the sake of decadence, as colors are somehow more vibrant to me than mere colors. It was in the woods of Germany that big bad wolves ate grandmothers and girls who dressed in red. It was Germany that hid the gingerbread house of a witch who hungered for children to roast in her oven. And somewhere in the mountains that we were doing our best to avoid, Rubzahl still wandered with his storm harp, shaking the earth or fogging the skies as the notion took him. We had successfully navigated northwest through farmlands and river crossings, and had recently threaded the space between Bergen on the north and Celle on the south. As we headed into a lovely wooded stretch that gave way to dank moors here and there, the sun sank before us and filtered through the needled branches of evergreens. Usually, there are only two kinds of script one sees in forests. Signs that warn off trespassers and hunters, and carved hearts in the trunks of trees with the initials of a couple who felt there was no more romantic thing they could do to celebrate their love than scar the local plant life. So, when I saw a neat white envelope pinned to a tree, addressed to the Shakespearean scholar in a neat calligraphic hand, I stopped to check it out and shifted to human. "Hold up," I called to Granuel and Oberon. "I need to take a look at this. Stay alert." Granuel shifted to human also.
"What is it?" she whispered.
"A note." The envelope was sealed with red wax and the old Norse word heft. Vengeance. The paper inside was a fine linen. There was no date or salutation or signature, just two lines from the Merchant of Venice, written with ink and quite possibly an old-fashioned quill. I read it aloud. "Thou call'st me dog before thou hadst a cause, but since I am a dog, beware my fangs."
"Fangs? They're called canines, duh."
"It's Shakespeare, Oberon."
"Oh, so that makes it okay? Of course it does. He could call a wolfhound a kitten, and you'd make excuses for him."
There was no postscript, nothing written on the back, nothing else in the envelope. "He expresses himself with economy."
"What?"
"Never mind," thinking aloud, unwisely. The clue was in the quote, "Vampires ahead." The last time I saw him, back in Thessalonica, Leif Helgerson had told me that he would try to warn me with Shakespeare when Theophilus was getting close. Theophilus was the old vampire who'd set the Romans after the ancient Druids, and had, until recently, thought we were all dead. Now that he knew we were alive, he wanted to finish the job. But it wasn't quite dark yet on our second day of running. That meant if Leif had left this note for me, he had to have left it before dawn, while we were still chugging through Poland. That spoke of an uncomfortable prescience regarding the route I was taking, even if someone in Tir na n'Og was doing the divining. The wind was behind us, and I was sure he wouldn't be able to tell, but I asked my hound anyway. "Oberon, do you smell the dead? Vampires?" My hound paused to sniff the air.
"Nope. You smell kind of wank, but not dead."
"Smell this envelope. Any trace of the dead on it?"
"Ha. Maybe a little. Smells more like a regular dude. But wait, let me see the note. Yes, the paper smells like a dead guy."
So, Leif had written the note, but someone human had left it here, most likely at his instruction. Oberon confirmed this after snuffling around a bit at the base of the tree.
"There was a guy here who smelled like cabbage and milk. He came from that direction," he said, pointing a paw south, "and left the same way."
"Well, there's some kind of bad guys ahead," I told Granuel, "if this note is to be believed. It suggests vampires, but they still have a while to sleep."
"Let's go around."
"Around where? We don't know how far away they are or anything else. This note may be intended to make us change our course. If we go south in the direction of the mysterious note delivery man, we'll be in the Hartz Mountains, and that won't be fun. If we go north, we risk getting pushed into the sea before we're ready. What we do know are two things. There are two huntresses on our tail who are gaining ground while we talk, and heading due west is the fastest route through this piece of country since it presents the fewest obstacles.
I'm sure the vampires know that too, she said. We should go around.
It's just now dusk, I pointed out. They can't all be up and waiting for us yet.
It's not worth the risk, she responded. Let's swing a single mile to the north and then turn west again. We'll avoid whatever's waiting ahead and lose no more than a few minutes.
All right. But let's go as humans so our weapons will be ready. Oberon and I in camouflage, you in full invisibility. Oberon, if you smell anybody but us, you let us know. Granuel disappeared from my sight, and her disembodied voice said,
After you.
I cast camouflage on my hound, and he shook as if he'd just gotten out of the bath.
That smell always tickles.
Are you going to giggle? We can market an invisible plush doll of you and call it the Tickle Me Oberon.
Who wants an invisible plush doll? You always want to be able to see what you're cuddling. Besides, giggling isn't my thing. Now, if you came out with a Feed Me Oberon or a Hump Me Oberon, that would sell like nothing else. Especially to people with poodles. Poodles would demand a Hump Me Oberon.
I laughed and cast camouflage on myself. Let's go, I said aloud, so that Granuel would hear as well. I headed north and continued the silly discussion in hopes that it would help me relax. How would poodles even know about it? They haven't learned language like you have.
Love is the universal language, Atticus. Put the Hump Me Oberon in those pet stores where they let dogs inside, and they'll figure it out.
You mean put your toy in the aisle with all the other plushies?
Exactly, except the Hump Me Oberon isn't a toy. Oh no, it's not for puppies. It's for grown-up poodles. Know what I'm saying?
Ha! Oh my gods, Oberon. The imagery. We had gone about 300 yards when we found ourselves at a wooded lake shore. The water looked inhospitable. We would fight both submerged plants and scum on the surface should we attempt to swim it. If we wanted to continue north, we'd have to go around. If we circled east, we'd be heading back toward the huntresses. If we went west, it would be toward whatever nameless threat waited for us. Bugger. Boxed in and we didn't even know it, I said. You okay with turning west, Granuel? Her voice answered from my right.
We don't have too far to go. It doesn't look like a long lake. We can swing back north on the other side of it. If vampires are waiting for us, I'd rather get past them if we can before they rise.
Good call. After clearing the lake shore and turning north, we broke into an odd-shaped field that might have been natural at one time, but had clearly been cultivated in the past. Now it lay fallow, with random weeds and grasses sprouting out of it. It was the sort of place one expected to find deer and the like, but no whitetails bounded away from us. No birds chirped either. Despite being in camouflage, I felt exposed. When moving quickly like this, I wasn't exactly invisible. The camouflage couldn't keep up with the constantly shifting background, and I could be seen as a distinct blur, especially since there was still a bit of sunlight left. Oberon, do you smell anything?
No, but the wind behind us isn't helping. All I can smell is stuff we've already passed.
I don't like this meadow. There's something out... Chapter 10
When the blurred shape of Atticus fell in front of me, at first I thought he simply tripped and I almost laughed, because pratfalls have been amusing since the Stone Age. Then I heard the belated crack of a rifle to the south, and Oberon's startled cry.
Atticus!
Stay with him, I said, as the training kicked in and I turned toward the direction of the shot. I'm on the threat. There was nothing I could do for Atticus that he couldn't do for himself, except address the sniper. And by address, I meant destroy him, no shriving time allowed. My scruples regarding the taking of life evaporate when people try to kill us.
Atticus! Atticus! Clever girl, he's not answering me!
Oberon said. He sounded truly panicked, and it began to worry me. But I had to worry about the sniper first, especially after I felt a bullet whip by my ear, and then heard the report right afterward. I was still invisible, but that was way too close for a random shot, especially since he'd obviously hit Atticus while he was in camouflage. Logic dictated that the sniper must be able to see us, probably using an infrared scope. Our spells did wonders in the visible spectrum, but did nothing to mask our heat signatures. Though I was reluctant to do it, I dropped my staff and said goodbye to my invisibility. Atticus had taught me that superior fighters sometimes lose because of a failure to adapt to a shift in the enemy's tactics. The enemy had clearly come prepared to fight against camouflage and invisibility, so it was time to mix it up. Sniper rifles are usually mounted on stands or pods and are ill-suited to taking out fast-moving aerial targets. So I shifted to a Peregrine Falcon and flew as fast as I could. I still wasn't terribly good at flying, but I figured it would get me above the canopy in one piece. Once I was above the trees, he'd have more trouble finding me than I would have finding him.
"There's all this blood on the ground. Can you help him, Granuelle? Please?"
"Stay and guard him, Oberon. Trying to make sure we don't get shot at anymore. I'll be there as soon as I can." I hoped it wasn't serious. Blood on the ground sounded serious, but I couldn't begin to think about what that might mean yet. If I allowed myself to get distracted, I wouldn't survive. Fight now, feel later. Another shot boomed through the early evening, but it wasn't close enough for me to sense its passing. I saw the muzzle flash and banked around in that direction. My eyesight as a falcon made me feel half-blind as a human by comparison. I could see 3 times the detail with my black eyes that I could with my green eyes. I could clearly track the sniper abandoning his stand and rifle and running through the forest from 200 yards away. From that distance, he was one hell of a sniper to hit Atticus on the run. He pulled a sidearm from his vest, one of the bulletproof type, not a waistcoat, and loaded a round into the chamber. All black gear, no natural materials for me to bind, and if I'd been trying to follow him with human eyes, even with night vision, he'd be tough to spot. But I was looking at him through a raptor's eyes. His silhouette stood out against the forest floor like ink on Bristol board. The sidearm would be a problem if he got a chance to use it. He hadn't exhibited any supernatural powers yet, nothing vampiric anyway, but he clearly had some paramilitary training at the very least, if not the real thing. I couldn't take him out as a falcon, so I considered my alternatives as I closed the distance between us. If I swooped down on him and changed to human, he might be able to get a lucky shot into me despite my training. I needed a quick kill. Dropping onto him as a sea lion was obviously a non-starter, and horses are not generally known for their mad assassination skills. I did have a jaguar form, but it was problematic for me. It came with an extraordinary sense of smell that triggered uncontrollable sneezing fits. At least, it had the first time I tried it. I hadn't taken the form since shortly after my tattoos were complete. I'd been too afraid to smell all those horrible things again. What if I turned into a jaguar, all snarly and toothy, and just sneezed on the guy instead of slaying him? He'd shoot me for sure, and that would be such a stupid way to die. But I had done some reading on how jaguars hunt. They had a surefire kill move, and I was fairly certain I could pull it off if I didn't think about it too much. The guy looked up over his shoulder, and I saw the infrared goggles. I dove in response, assuming he'd take a wild shot. He didn't. I'm not sure he spotted me. I threaded my way through the canopy and then leveled out underneath it, gaining on him fast and still maintaining some altitude above him. He was changing directions, little jukes here and there to try to fake me out. That wasn't going to happen. He might be a trained soldier, but there was no way he could hope to be faster than me as a falcon, or as a jaguar for that matter, or even in my normal form juiced up on the Earth's magic. I pointed myself to a spot ahead of him and folded my wings in tight against my body, gaining speed as I dove and keeping silent. I quietly opened my beak to its full extent as I approached the top of his head and shifted to a jaguar an instant before landing heavily on top of him. I rode him down to the ground, my jaws clamped around his skull, and bit down as hard as I could. He screamed and shot the gun once, a spasm of his finger more than anything else, and died with his blood filling my mouth. He twitched a few times, And that, coupled with the blood and brains on my tongue, freaked me out. I shifted to human and couldn't control my revulsion. I spat a couple of times, felt the chunks of brain pass my lips, and then vomited right on top of his body. It was so much worse than sneezing. I crawled away as soon as my stomach gave me half a chance. "Threat neutralized," I told Oberon.
"Good. Now come back and help Atticus. I don't know what to do."
"He still hasn't moved or said anything to you?"
"No. I don't see how he can. He's been shot in the head."
Something lurched in my stomach again, and I suddenly felt cold. I heard a tiny voice wail, "No, no, no," but there was no one else around to make those sounds but me.
"You didn't say that before!"
I scrambled to my feet and pelted back toward the meadow, leaving the sniper's body to rot.
"I'm sorry, I can't think straight. You can heal him, right? He's not really dead."
"Wait, what does he smell like?" Oberon held his head low, his ears and tail drooping as he paced worriedly around his still form. The wailing voice that said, "No, no, no," got louder.
"He smells dead, but my nose has been wrong before. I think, I hope."
"Oh, gods, I hope you're wrong, too." The enormity of what had happened began to catch up with me. Leaf's warning of an ambush had been legit. It just hadn't manifested itself as vampires the way Atticus had thought. I reached Oberon in the next few seconds, and my throat tightened at what I saw. Atticus was sprawled on his right side, blood pooled underneath his head. His eyes were open and unblinking. The entry wound near his left temple was a small black hole, not red or a bruised purple. A small black hole. I knelt next to him and put a finger underneath his nose to see if he was breathing. He didn't appear to be, and I felt no puff of air on my finger. I searched for a pulse on his neck but found nothing. I tried his wrist. I put my ear down to his chest and hoped I could hear something over the voice saying, "No, no, no." All was still. And though these indications were all of a kind and pointed to a terrible conclusion, the worst for me was that Oberon was plainly visible. And so was Atticus. They had both been running in camouflage, and Atticus had been the one to cast it.
"Is he dead?"
Oberon asked. A small black hole. No vital signs. That should have done it, but it was having to answer Oberon, saying it aloud that broke me. "Yes," I cried, my voice quavering. "He's gone. I can't do anything." And then we both howled. We howled the way people do when they don't care about speaking anymore, because the words don't exist that can properly convey their emotions. Only ragged, broken, discordant noises could come close. And there are always tears and snot and gasping too, gasping because there isn't enough wind to cry all that they feel in a single breath. For what else was there to do? CPR wouldn't help with a head wound. I couldn't make his heart beat if his brain wasn't fucking there. Druidry only gave me the power to heal, not resurrect. He died before he finished falling. The little black hole in the side of his head swelled until it filled my vision, a distortion brought on by my tears. Knowing I'd already avenged him gave me no satisfaction. I had him for only a few weeks. I'd thought we would be happy together forever. And I think I might have said that out loud to his body in a sort of high-pitched, incoherent keening that approximated speech but wasn't intelligible. 12 years of longing and being with him every day, closer to 13 if you counted the year flirting at Rulabula before I began my training, 13 years of repression and stupid surrogate boyfriends so that I would be a stronger druid, but only a few weeks of openly loving each other, ended by a small black hole in the side of his head. No chance to tell him goodbye or let him know one more time how grateful I was to be bound to the earth. No chance to let him tease me and then tease him back harder. No chance to cuss at him in old Irish because he said it made him feel young again, or put on strawberry lip gloss and watch him go dizzy. He'd always had a thing about that for some reason. I don't precisely know how long we cried over Atticus, but the moon was high in the sky, probably close to midnight, and my throat was raw before I remembered that Artemis and Diana were still after us. We'd probably cried away much of our lead. "Oberon," I said, "we have to go."
"No, I'm not leaving him."
"We have to. The Huntresses are coming."
"I don't care."
"Atticus would care. You know that. He would want us to run and thwart them. We will bury him and say our farewells, and then we will honor him by sticking it to the Olympians."
"How are we going to do that?"
"By making it to England. Surviving will piss them off and make Atticus proud."
"But I don't want to go to England. They're not Irish. And he's my friend."
"I know, Oberon. But staying here and letting the Olympians kill us won't make him happy. Us either, for that matter." Oberon ignored my wisdom and asked,
"Where is he now? In Tiernanog? Marmel? Can we go see him there?"
I didn't know where he was. Normally the Morrigan would escort spirits to their final resting place, but she was dead now. Perhaps Mananon MacLear would know. Maybe Atticus and the Morrigan were together somewhere. "I'm not sure where he is, Oberon, but I'm sure we can't see him. The dead and the living can inhabit the same places in the Summerlands, but they do not mix."
"Wherever he is, I want to go there too."
"No, Oberon. I need you to stay with me. Please? Let's send him off properly."
"But we don't have any whiskey. We can't have a wake without whiskey."
"We will have whiskey as soon as we find a liquor store." Fragora was lying a short distance away, so I retrieved it and placed it on the ground in front of him. I didn't roll him over or anything like that. I couldn't bear to see the other side of his head. The small black hole would haunt me forever as it was. I didn't want to see anything worse. I closed my eyes, pressing tears down my cheeks, and used my Latin headspace to contact the local elemental, Saxony. "Druid needs aid. Bury body and sword here. Keep surface undisturbed."
"Harmony,"
came the reply. Atticus and Fragora sank into the earth, and the turf nearby sort of stretched and closed over him, adjusting itself to make it appear as if nothing had ever happened there. No blood, no marker to indicate that the finest druid to ever walk the earth ended his walk in this nameless field. My voice wasn't up to speaking aloud, so I spoke mentally to Oberon. "Here lies Sheahan O'Sullivan," I said, "known as Atticus to us. He changed my life forever, for the better, and I can never repay the debt I owe him. All I can do is honor his memory by protecting the earth." I paused, confronted by the impossibility of doing justice to my memories of him. So I simply ended with, "I loved him, and will think of him every day, no matter how long I live." I sobbed once, and then did my best to weep silently so that Oberon would know it was his turn. He whined, indecisive, before he gave form to his thoughts.
"Atticus was the best human being ever,"
Oberon said.
"And I'm not just saying that because he gave me sausages. He taught me language, for one thing, so I could enjoy movies while he was at work. He told me stories in the bath and took me hunting and for jogs around the neighborhood. And once in a while, if I kept bothering him about it, he would give me some time with a really hot poodle bitch. And you know what else? He gave the best belly wubs because he knew what it was like. He was a hound, too. The best part about hanging out with Atticus was when we went running together as hounds. We felt the wind on our noses and ran until we found a field of clover, and then we'd flop on our backs and wiggle around in it and take a nap in the sun. He knew how to be a hound's best friend. I loved him. I don't think I'll ever wag my tail again. That's all."
I petted Oberon and stood shakily. I sniffled and looked up at the moon. Its cold light gave me no comfort. It only reminded me of Artemis and Diana. I cast my eyes back down to the ground and shook my head. There had been no vampires waiting for us. Only a sniper, probably in their employ, determined to wipe out the last of the druids. And even the vampires were being directed by some shadowy figure in Tir na n'Og. I really need to run now. I need to get out of here.
I'm with you.
I shifted to a horse and found Scavenger where I'd dropped it. Then I lit out for the Netherlands with Oberon, as if we could somehow catch up with what we'd lost. As if the desolation we felt could be left behind, and wouldn't grow inside us with every mile.
Chapter 11.
A pair of horns blast behind me. I am chilled with a premonition of my own death, and I wish for the thousandth time that Atticus were here. Did he find horns to be harbingers of death and sorrow? I cannot ever ask him now. Instead of when the saints go marching in, I always hear taps at funerals, and somehow the collective sorrow of so many final farewells builds in my mind. A great Jungian unconscious flood of tears and roses thrown on caskets and folded flags given to widows by a pair of crisp white gloves. That horn that plays in the John Williams score after Luke Skywalker finds the smoking ruins of his aunt and uncle, such a mournful sound, full and hollow at the same time, a surfeit of emptiness. And the call to charge never rouses me, but rather signals that someone is going to die a violent death soon. Or, if it starts a race or contest, it means there can be only one victor. The horns that blasted behind me were dim, nasal, and stuffy sounds that nevertheless meant the goddesses were gaining on us, and they weighted down my legs, which were already straining, not from fatigue, but from dolor. These were the sounds of horns and hunting that, according to myth, brought Actaeon to Diana as she was bathing. He'd been lost in the woods and thought that by following the sounds of horns, he'd be saved. But Diana had turned him into a stag and set her hounds on him instead. Those horns had called him to his death. Is she still sounding the same horn all these centuries later? And is there anything more horrifying to the hunted than the sound of horns? Even the baying of the hounds is not so terrible. They are animals and following their instinct and training. But the murderous intellect behind the horn, the creature coldly orchestrating my doom, that's what makes me feel like prey and sets icy wings of fear fluttering inside my throat. I probably would have given up already if it weren't for Oberon. And he is probably thinking the same thing regarding me. In truth, we are running only because Atticus would have wanted us to. I think we are only marginally more scared than we are depressed, and we aren't running as fast as we had been before. The urgency is gone. I don't see how I can survive this if Atticus and the Morrigan couldn't. The powers of a druid are awesome, but the powers arrayed against me are too numerous and in a different league. I'm not going to quit, but I feel like I'm on a soccer team losing 3-0 with 10 minutes left on the clock. While winning in that scenario is still theoretically possible, I don't see a way to make it happen all by myself, and I half wish that the end would hurry up and get here, banishing the dread of its approach. We crossed the border into the Netherlands, and the elemental directed me to turn sharply to the southwest to avoid the bulk of cities by the sea. We'd have had to turn south at some point anyway to reach the French coast. It's odd sometimes how a border can seemingly change the character of the land. The German landscape had been sharp, clean, and precise, whereas the Dutch, even at night, had a bit of a gauzy filter over it, as if the ghost of Rembrandt had pulled his brush across it to soften the edges just a little bit. The colors I saw in my night vision, too, appeared subtly textured and mixed by the master, not so stark as they had been in Germany. Or perhaps it was no different at all, and only my melancholia made it so. Noting the change of direction, Oberon said in a subdued tone,
"Hey, clever girl."
"Yes?" He let some time pass, and all we heard was the pounding of my hooves and the pads of his paws on the earth. They beat out a rhythm of cycling thought, the percussive notes repeating Atticus over and over, if you were inclined to hear it that way. And we were. Then he said,
"Do you know how far we still have to go?"
"Not precisely. Why?"
"Do you think we'll make it there before the huntresses catch up to us?"
The horns sounded again. Perhaps my imagination magnified the sound a bit. "I'm not sure, Oberon. I hope we do."
"I hope so, too. But I'm wondering how realistic it is. I've been thinking that if I have to go out, I'd like to go out fighting instead of running. I want to face the Predator. I don't want to get to the chopper with Arnold. You remember those guys? Well, they weren't real guys. What I mean is, did you ever see that movie?"
"You mean Predator? Yeah, I've seen it."
"Really? It's no wonder Atticus thought you were perfect."
He thought. I felt as if my eyes should be flooding with tears, but horses don't cry the same way humans do. Oberon continued, not waiting for me to finish.
"There was that one character who decided to take off his guns and meet the Predator with just a knife. I forget what his name was, but I'll never forget what he did. Everybody was crapping their pants and scrambling for the chopper, but he was like, 'Hell with that, homies. I'm not running from my problems. I'm going to face them, even if they kill me. But first, I'm going to slowly cut open my own chest and make some crazy eyes.' And then the Predator did kill him, and pretty fast, too. But I always respected his decision to take that stand. He was like, 'Fuck the chopper, Arnold!' Oh, will you excuse my language?"
"You're excused."
"Thank you. So that was his attitude, except he never said a word. You just knew what he was thinking. And now I'm kind of thinking the same thing. When the goddesses first appeared and shot those arrows at us, I was so startled that I peed. And I feel ashamed of that now."
"You don't have to be, Oberon."
"I think I do. I think I've had a longer and better life than any hound has ever had, and I shouldn't fear death. Am I right, Granuelle? I'm not very good at time, but I'm pretty old for a wolfhound, aren't I?"
"The oldest ever," I told him. "You're legendary."
"Well, I don't feel legendary, but I do feel old. So old that I probably shouldn't be here. I've had more than my fair share of sausage and bacon and steak, and I don't feel like running anymore. I feel like stopping here and putting up the fight that Atticus never got a chance to put up himself."
Oberon abruptly quit running, and I had to stop too. We were in the middle of a large barley field.
"You go on, clever girl. Get to the chopper."
He turned to face the northeast and growled,
"We'll see who pees first this time."
My instinct for self-preservation spoke up. It told me I could survive this. I could drop Skawaja, abandon Oberon, and turn into a peregrine falcon. I could fly straight across the channel to England, find a tethered tree, and shift away to safety. They couldn't have pandemonium going on over there, too, I thought. Somewhere in the New World, maybe even back in Arizona, I'd bind my amulet to my aura the way Atticus did, and then the playing field would be a bit more even. Except, I'd never be able to live with the guilt. And I'd never have the stomach to fight again if I didn't fight now. "Oberon, this isn't the place to take a stand."
"You can't talk me out of this. I'm doing it."
"I'm not trying to talk you out of it. I'm with you 100%. Fuck the chopper, okay?"
"Well, okay then. What's the problem?"
"This isn't the right place to do it. You have to choose your battleground more wisely. The huntresses have hounds now, remember?"
"So?"
"So you're standing in open ground where they can surround you."
"Oh.
We need to get to a place where we can put our backs to a wall and not get flanked. Make them face you. Remember how the guy in the movie chose a spot carefully?"
"Yeah, it was this river valley or something with a log across it. He stopped there."
"Exactly, And do you see why he did it?
The Predator had to come straight at him. Couldn't get across without going through him first.
That's right, and that's what we need to do. We need to find a spot like that where we can do the most damage possible.
Whoa, horsey! We?
Silly dog, didn't you hear me? I'm not going anywhere without you.
Awesome!
I had thought Oberon's tail might wag at that, but it didn't. He simply pricked up his ears.
Do you know a good place around here?
No, but I'm sure the elemental does. Let's keep going while I figure it out. The ears drooped.
Hey, wait a minute, clever girl. You're not trying to trick me into running away, are you?
I raised my right front hoof. Pretend I'm raising my right hand. I swear, by all that's holy...
You mean sausage and bitches?
I swear, by sausage and bitches, that I am not trying to trick you. We will find a good place to fight, and then that's what we'll do.
Okay, let's do this.
We ran, and I consulted the elemental about a suitable place to defend ourselves. Images of the path ahead flashed through my mind until I saw a likely spot. There, that place. Query, where is that? It was a small precipice, only 15 or so feet high, but if we could get our backs to it, we would have a relatively unobscured line of sight, and no one would be able to sneak up on us. There were trees on top of it, but at the base a small clear space before the trees broke up the view. And the approach was on a gentle slope as well, so we'd have the high ground.
Remain on current path,
the elemental said.
We'll guide.
Query, distance to destination? Elementals are not excellent at using human units of measurement, but I figured it was about 80 miles to the southwest, skirting cities and keeping to rural areas as much as possible. If we sped up, we could make it in a couple of hours.
2 hours run, I told Oberon. That's not bad. We can stay ahead for a couple of hours.
Sure, no problem. Atticus drilled me on this. An hour is the one with 60 seconds in it, right?
Never mind. Just keep up with me, and we can do this.
Chapter 12. Our minds are all that defend us from the horror of the void. The majority of the time, we simply think about something, anything else, and that itself is an act of defiance against the vast nothing of the universe. But minds break down and stop thinking sometimes. They feel instead. A looping, gnawing monster eats away confidence and goals and even a sense of duty until we are in a dry, bleak place of ennui, unable to focus on the minutiae that used to keep us moving. Tongues taste chalk and ashes, and eyes see only gray washes occasionally penetrated by bright stabs of panic. Depression is a prison to which you have the key, except you never think to look for it. I do not know how long I stayed in the gray, afraid of the nothing and cycling through the long list of my trespasses. I cannot conceive of a judge who could grant me forgiveness. There are some shames I can never outlive. What good would it do to continue? Had I not brought enough ruin to the world, especially in the recent past? But it was the panic that saved me. Panic that Granuel and Oberon would die. I could not bear to have their deaths added to the vast number that already weighed down the scale of my spirit. My eyes opened onto darkness, which was not precisely heartening, but an improvement over the gray. Adrenaline coursed through me as I attempted to get my bearings. Cold earth shifted under my right side, and I winced at the pain this small movement caused in my head. Stretching out with my left arm and feeling the boundaries of the space with my fingers, I quickly discovered that I was in a small chamber underground, obviously with some rudimentary air circulation. Fragorah rested in front of my face in its scabbard. Beyond that, I had no idea where I was, except that Granuel and Oberon weren't with me. We had been running for our lives. Why was I not running? Why had I been reviewing my life with such self-loathing? Query, Carpathia? No, Saxony.
Saxony was a German elemental. Why was I in Germany?
We'd been in Poland, and Hugin and Moonen had visited us. Then we'd run, and... yes, we had crossed into Germany. There had been that attempt to find an old way to Tir na n'og, and then we found that envelope on the tree. Oh. Query. How did I get here?
Fierce Druid placed you here. Thought you deceased.
I blinked as I processed the fact that Elementals had decided to refer to Granuaile as Fierce Druid. Query. Then why do I have space and air to breathe?
I provided. Druid had not moved on.
No, I hadn't. And apparently I didn't rate an adjective in front of my title. I was just plain old Druid. Query. What happened to me?
Projectile impact ahead.
Someone had shot me? So that's why my head ached. My fingers trailed up to my head and gently traced their way around it. There was a dimple near my left temple that hadn't been there before, and it was tender. I was sure the exit wound on the other side had been heinous, but I didn't want to lift my head and probe it. I was still healing. I let my hand drop down to my necklace, where I groped for the last charm on the left side of my necklace, the one I'd never used before.
"Guess you worked after all," I said.
Granuaile had asked me what it was for once. I told her it was my version of a soul catcher. I'd made it in response to Napoleon's invasion of Russia. I was a medic for the Russians during that time and saw what musket fire could do, what it meant for an old druid who had protections against magic, but not against high-velocity hunks of lead. I'd seen guns before that, of course, but had avoided them as best as I could. Joining the Russians had been a sort of fact-finding tour, with the sterling bonus that I got to wear those fun furry hats. I decided I'd be able to survive most any hit to the body, given time to heal, except for a direct hit to the heart. I could armor myself against that. Shots to the head, however, presented a rather monumental problem. Brain death didn't allow one time to heal, and the brain was the warehouse for the spirit. Punch a hole in that, and you'd shuffle off your mortal coil right away. Keeping your coil unshuffled was the problem. Healing of the gross physical body could happen on autopilot as long as my tattoos had contact with the earth. I didn't need to consciously direct that, and it technically didn't require a beating heart. But keeping my spirit anchored to my body with a hole in my head, well, that was tougher, and, as it happens, entirely necessary to keep the healing happening. It was sometime during the process of binding my cold iron amulet to my aura that I realized I was really altering the nature of my spirit. And if I could do that to my spirit, I might be able to do other things as well. I spent years perfecting my other charms until I decided in the 19th century to attempt the soul catcher. Despite the recent name I'd given to the charm, I'm reluctant to use the word soul. It has some pretty awful baggage with it, the kind that's been roughed up quite a bit and thrown around without any regard for what might be inside. As I told Granuaile once, I had no idea whether it would work or not. To test it, I'd have to die. And I guess I had died. With rare exceptions, people who get shot in the head do that. Granuaile wouldn't have buried me if my heart had been beating. So the charm had worked precisely as I had intended. All of my charms are triggered by mental commands. Without them, I'd have to speak the words aloud every time for every binding, as Granuaile does. But you can't very well trigger a mental command when your brain has been blown out. So, I had triggered it back in the 19th century and hoped I'd never have occasion to discover whether it worked or not. The charm executed a series of bindings, three of which were conditional. The first one bound my spirit to my corporeal form even if my heart stopped beating, a sort of soul cage using the framework I'd already established by binding my amulet to my aura. The second took a snapshot of my physical brain every 5 minutes, accounting for every synapse and neuron, and that had been ongoing since I triggered it in 1812. The third was a healing command, automatically drawing upon the earth, so long as my spirit remained, to heal my head in accordance with the last stored image of my brain down to the last cell. And once those had been accomplished, the fourth slammed my spirit back into its mortal coil, my brain,
and got everything working again. The theory was that my heart would start pumping, the lungs would start breathing, and I'd hopefully rise from the dead without fangs or a shambling gait and with my personality and memories intact. So much could have gone wrong. Getting decapitated, vaporized in a giant orange ball of flame, or losing so much blood that I could never get the heart pumping again. Getting shot on the roof of a building with no hope of contacting the earth. Heck, falling in the field in such a way that none of my tattoos touched the ground would have been disastrous all by itself. The charm was by no means fail-safe insurance against death, but the effort I'd spent on it had clearly paid off. The gray wash abruptly returned to my vision, the black pitch of the earth fading. What would I do with a new lease on life? Find new and gruesome ways to doom everyone alive? Speak without thinking? Make Faustian bargains with witches and frost giants? Save Granuel and Oberon now, only to see them die at the hands of Loki later? That would be unkind. It would be more merciful to leave them to Artemis and Diana, who favored the quick kill. I would never have allowed myself to think that way in the company of others. But one is never so alone as in the grave. I could feel all this, and no one would overhear or suspect. For all that we may sometimes despise our fellows and be driven to rages and petty revenges, I think we are even darker creatures when we are alone. We can learn to fear our own thoughts more than the lash of the whip or the slap in the face. At least, that is how I imagine it is for people cursed with self-awareness. Two regrets pulled me out of the gray. If I did nothing, I would never see Granuel's freckles again. Or those green eyes. Or smell her strawberry lip gloss. Well, okay, it was more than two regrets. Three. Three regrets. And damn if Oberon didn't deserve a poodle or some kind of companion besides me. All right, four regrets. Probably more the longer I thought about it. A fair measure of pride had something to do with me clawing my way to the surface as well. I couldn't stand the thought of Theophilus smiling a smug smile and drinking a goblet full of blood, toasting the final demise of druids on the earth. He had a metric fuckton of bad karma due him, and I hoped I'd be the one to back up the truck and dump it on his undead ass. And gods below, didn't the Morrigan deserve a shred of effort on my part after what she'd done for me? I clutched Fragorod tightly as Saxony helped me rise to the surface. Query, where is Fierce Druid and Druid Friend?
No longer in my realm.
They must have already left Germany. If Granuel had decided to follow the plan, they could be in the Netherlands or even Belgium by now. Query, plot straight line to them for me? Speak with neighboring elementals?
Pleasure. Harmony.
Harmony. Tell Fierce Druid nothing. I didn't want Granuel and Oberon to slow down or decide to wait for me when the Huntresses would be close behind. And since they were still probably being watched, I didn't want to tip anyone off that I was walking the earth again.
Harmony,
Saxony said once more. When I emerged into the air, it was deep night. If Saxony could trace Granuel through a neighboring elemental, then it was probably the same night that I had been shot. It was entirely possible. Brain tissue is not so heavy or dense as muscle tissue, and I hadn't needed to replace all of it, just a few ounces of a bullet's path. Tracks led to the northwest. Dogs and deer. The Huntresses had been through here already, and their hounds were sniffing out Granuel and Oberon. Saxony pointed me just south of west. I shifted to a stag, picked up Fragorod between my lips, and ran. More worried than I'd ever been. Once, when I'd taken a knife and a kidney, and another between the shoulders from the hammers of God, no less a deity than Jesus had told me the pain I'd felt then was a fraction of what I'd feel if I followed through with my chosen course of action. And while I've never worshipped him, I do know he's not the sort of God who lies to people. At the time, I couldn't imagine anything worse than my current pain, because I was out of magic then, and damaged kidneys fucking hurt. But now I thought I knew what Jesus meant. Free of the gray wash of depression and thinking straight, losing Granuel and Oberon would be... Well, I didn't have words for that kind of agony.
Maybe I had my own dump truck of bad karma waiting for me somewhere ahead. I had certainly earned it, but I raced to avoid it if I could. There was no way I wanted to feel that.
Chapter 13.
Oberon and I run much faster now that we have a destination and a purpose, even though the Netherlands has proven to be something of an obstacle course. We have had many more roads to cross, and skirting the population is a challenge, but it's aided by the night. Millions of Dutch folk slumber in peace, spooning perhaps with someone they love, snoring the snores of the unhunted, and remain blissfully unaware that magic is real, and a very old branch of it is doomed to perish in their borders. As the sky broadcasts a pale gray warning of an incipient sunrise, I spy a sign welcoming me to Veluwezoom National Park, except that the Dutch spell it Nationaal, which I kind of like. The bonus vowel suggests abundance, as if their country is stuffed with a surpassing bounty of natural gifts. It is a not unreasonable conclusion. Veluwezoom is a serene stretch of heath and assorted trees, the latter huddled together around the perimeter of the park and giving shelter to innumerable critters that Oberon, were he not so forlorn, would have loved to harass. The leaves on the trees fly flags of red and orange and yellow, heralding with the brightest pageantry the decline of their vigor. Seeing that, Atticus would be smiling and starting to talk about celebrating Samhain soon, if he were here. Missing people in our lives are like wounds we reopen with thoughts. Our destination lay at the far end of a field of grass and heather that sloped ever so gently up to it. Once there, at the base of the small tree-topped cliffside the elemental had shown me, I shifted to human and turned to survey our trail. I beheld a vista of fading green and pale lavender, contoured slopes of plants crouching patiently in the pre-dawn gray, waiting for the first blazon of the sun to light their edges with fire and joy. Oberon turned with me, nose in the air, sampling its scent, and ears twitching at the sound of birds waking up for the morning's natter. They were located in small handfuls of trees on either side of the cliff that constricted our view of the periphery. Perhaps they found the prospect of the heath as stunning as we did. It was a shy, muted beauty, ready to be seen and applauded.
"Is this the place, Guanyuel?"
"This is the place. Backs to the wall like I promised."
"And no chopper?"
"That's right. No chopper." The great hound gave a sigh and stretched himself out on the grass, paws in front, sphinx-like, and kept his eyes scanning the horizon.
"There are worse places where one could make an end."
"Much worse," I agreed, though this time I spoke mind to mind. If this was to be my final sunrise, I wanted to appreciate the soundtrack without my voice stomping on it. I petted Oberon, and he let me do it, but I noted that he didn't wag his tail even a little bit.
"You know what would be totally pie to have a long white now, since we can't have Atticus?"
Oberon said as we waited. "What would be pie?"
"Some hogs of war, mounted with special ops spider monkeys. Nobody would expect that. Or the Spanish Inquisition."
"What are you talking about?"
"You know what I mean. It's from that play by Shakespeare, and I figured Atticus would have appreciated that."
"Shakespeare had a hog-mounted monkey cavalry? In which play?"
"I don't remember the whole thing, because it was very long, but Atticus recited it for me once, and there was a line that went like this. 'Quai ham hoc, and let slip the hogs of war.' I know you might not agree, but for me, that was the best thing Shakespeare ever wrote."
"You mean 'cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war' from Julius Caesar?"
"No, I don't think that's it. There was ham in there. I'm sure he was talking about ham. They were going to battle hunger."
"I think you might have been hungry when you heard it, Oberon." A clipped puff of wind was echoed by another, and in another few seconds these could be recognized as the distant barking of hounds. A horn, much clearer than before, rode the air behind it.
The huntresses were approaching the bounds of the park, with their pack leading the way. I wasn't looking forward to meeting the pack, but it was necessary if he wanted to have a shot at Artemis and Diana. And these weren't going to be cute little snuggly-wuggly puppies. They'd be trained killers. If I didn't treat them as such, I'd be dinner. If I had my druthers, I wouldn't have minded some help either. Some more modern, realistic help than what Oberon wanted. U.S. Marines, for example. I'd say, "Sorry, fellas, but these enemy combatants, Artemis and Diana, happen to be immortal. They can't be killed." The Marines would exchange glances, and then their platoon leader, who would be a nice young gentleman from the South, totally polite and unable to drink legally, would say, "Well, miss, we respectfully doubt their immortality, because they have yet to meet the applied force we can bring to bear. Semper Fi." I sighed and banished the nice deadly Marines from my head. Atticus told me once that people never survive battle because they wish it. They survive because of their actions, the actions of their allies, or the inaction of their enemies. That is all. I cast camouflage on Oberon and invisibility on myself. I gave us both the same speed and strength bindings. Oberon took point, and I set myself up behind him, back against the tiny cliff. He'd break the charge, and if any of them got past and tried to turn and snap at him from behind, I'd be there to brain them with my staff. I had a throwing knife ready, though, and two more resting in the holster I'd strapped to my thigh. That would do for some of them. I'm not very knowledgeable when it comes to dog breeds. The hounds given to Artemis and Diana in ancient days would probably not conform to any modern breed anyway. I wondered if these were the original hounds, kept eternally youthful like Oberon, or if they were descendants of the originals. When they appeared, I saw that they weren't bloodhounds with big floppy ears. They were more like big spaniels or retrievers and of varying coat colors. They were all smaller than Oberon anyway, but there were 14 of them and two of us. Their inability to see us gave us a significant advantage, I must admit. All they could do was smell us. The first one ran into Oberon, and it went about as well for him as charging into a brick wall. All forward momentum ceased abruptly as Oberon batted him down with a paw and then followed up with his jaws. I threw two knives, and they found their marks. Then the pack flowed around us, and it was all teeth and a whirling staff until they were still, and we remained. "You okay, Oberon?" I asked.
"Some scratches, but nothing serious. You?"
"The same. We need to move to one side now, away from the bodies, and keep low until it's time to pounce. They're going to be mad and pour some arrows in here, I bet."
"Are we going to try to take them one at a time?"
"I guess so. Pick one and jump on her back. I'll try to make sure she stays down as much as any of the Olympians can stay down. You have to watch out. They'll have knives, and they're going to be super fast."
"I don't care about facing the knives. That's kind of the point."
"Gods, Oberon." This time, when the tears came, I had proper eyes to let them loose, and I wiped them furiously from my cheeks. "You need to think strategically instead of suicidally. If Atticus were here, he'd kill me for even allowing you to risk yourself this much." Oberon gave a soft whine.
"If he were here, I wouldn't be suggesting it."
I reached for something positive to say, but couldn't lay hold of a single word. I knew exactly what he meant. For all its manifold beauties, the world is never so fine once someone you love leaves it. Instead, there is only the bleak prospect of loneliness and might-have-beens. "Look, the killer virgins are going to live through this, and we won't," I said. "But I want them to feel ambushed. When it's over, I want them to shudder and realize that we would have owned them if they were mortal."
"Okay, clever girl. That sounds good. I'll order a slice of that."
We didn't have long to wait. Two golden chariots pulled by teams of stags glided over the heather as the sun crested the horizon in the east. Once they saw the bodies of their hounds, the goddesses reined the stags in and leapt out, each with a bow in hand and an arrow nocked and ready to go. It was my first real good look at them. They'd been quite a distance away back in Romania, and the Morrigan had blocked my view before I had time to study them. Based on my experience with Hermes and Mercury, I was pretty sure that Artemis was the paler of the two. Neither was dressed in bedsheets or the flowing, skimpy dresses one sees so often in fantasy art, and they weren't rocking the hooded elf look either. Lean and wiry, dark hair queued and gathered in golden circlets, Artemis wore a sleeveless, pale green tunic gathered at the waist with a broad belt. She had black pants tucked into some of those calf-high boots that looked like moccasins, but none of it was leather. All polyester and other synthetic materials. And the circlets in her hair weren't gold. They were plastic. I knew because I tried to create a binding between them and the earth, which would effectively pull her to the ground by her hair, but it didn't work. Same thing with her belt buckle, and her bow and arrows were man-made composites, too. I had no doubt that the knife strapped to her thigh was a composite as well. Artemis was a sharp and stringy sort, jaw like a hatchet blade and muscles in her forearms rippling like piano wires. She didn't head straight for the pile of hound corpses, but circled to her right, where Oberon and I were hiding. She approached us in a crouching step, eyes flicking around for signs of us. Diana circled the other way in a similar gait. The Roman goddess was a bit softer around the edges than her Greek counterpart, and she had made a bit more effort to find clothing that echoed her ancient origins. She was wearing one of those armor skirts centurions used to wear, except hers was made of black pleather or some other unholy creation of fabric science. She had some black greaves on over her sandals, too. Like Mercury, her skin was bronzed and seemed to glow as if she'd been waxed and polished in a detail shop. She was hot, to a degree that was rather unfair. They took very different approaches to their famous virginity. Artemis's complete lack of attention to her personal appearance meant she couldn't care less what men thought of her, while Diana appreciated the tease of looking desirable yet untouchable. I used to admire them both when they were simply myths, for they represented two of the world's earliest memos to men that women could get along quite well without them, and enjoy a full measure of happiness besides, thank you very much. It was more difficult to admire them now that they were hunting me, however. Artemis looked as if she might wind up stepping on us at one point, and that would have been dangerous when she had a bow ready to fire. But she changed her path to draw nearer to the hounds. I saw that in a few moments she'd be presenting her back to us. "Get to your feet silently once she passes us, and jump on her back," I said to Oberon.
"Got it. This will be easy."
I should have stopped him right there because he jinxed it. But he rose to his feet silently, as did I, gathered himself and sprang at her back when she was no more than 2 yards away. And though I had granted Oberon extraordinary speed, Artemis was still faster. Sensing the attack somehow, she dropped her bow and arrow, raised her left arm, leaned to her right, and caught Oberon in a chokehold.
"Ah, she got me!"
He tried to wrestle loose, but Artemis held fast and drew her knife. She held it up to his neck and said in English,
"Be still. I can't see you properly, so be sure you don't cut your own throat."
That prevented me from sweeping her legs as I'd planned. The situation had changed. I began to sidestep to the left, still behind her, but away from her knife hand. If she wanted to take it away from his throat and throw it in my direction, she'd have to do it across her body. But she was counting on her partner to keep me at bay, and I was all too aware that Diana was the more dangerous in this scenario. She still had a bow and could skewer me quickly if she sussed out my position.
"Do it, Oberon. Don't struggle."
"How did she know where we were?"
"I don't know," I said, and wished that I did. I wasn't as good at strategy and tactics as Atticus was. This entire scheme had been ill-advised from the start, and I'd been stupid to think I could outwit two immortal huntresses. 30 yards away, Diana's eyes searched for me. They didn't fall precisely on my position, but they were close. I tried to move as quietly as I could, but felt I had to keep moving. If she got a fix on my position, there would be no time to dodge.
"Your master is dead, young druid, but you need not follow him,"
Diana called. It occurred to me to wonder how precisely they knew Atticus was dead. Did they find where I'd buried him and dig him up? Had someone told them? Or were they able to communicate with their hounds, like druids could, and learn from them that they'd lost one of their prey? I answered my own question with my next thought. If it hadn't been one of the Olympians, then dryads had probably told them, or some other spirits of nature. We no doubt passed our share during our run.
"Release Bacchus, and we will spare you."
"And the hound?" I said, moving as I did so.
"Since you have killed all of mine, I think your hound should die too," Artemis answered. "But I will be generous if you bargain in good faith now. This is not simply a hound to you, is it? This is a friend."
"Yes, he is. If you kill him, or harm him in any way, you'll get nothing from me. Bacchus will be lost forever." Diana was doing her best to zero in on my voice, her head slightly cocked, but her eyes tracking me accurately now.
"I understand," she said. "Bacchus is a friend of ours. Release our friend, and we will release yours. Everyone lives. Everyone goes home unbruised. Our quarrel was never with you."
"I call bullshit."
"And yet you've hunted me for many miles," I said.
"Only to recover Bacchus," Diana replied.
She was inching closer, bow at the ready.
"We never sought your death."
"If you wish to talk, then talk," I said. "Stop moving and drop your bow, Diana, or I might begin to suspect you do seek my death after all." Diana gave a tiny smile and stopped advancing, but didn't drop her bow.
"Very well, mortal. If you're willing to be reasonable, we can talk."
"Diana, wait," Artemis said. "I don't think we're alone."
Chapter 14. Artemis heard me coming, but it wasn't in time. Distracted sufficiently by the negotiation with Diana and Granuaile, she realized too late that there was, indeed, someone else out there. It was me, the dead guy, with Fragora in my left hand, and approaching behind her right shoulder, swinging with all I had at the base of her neck. Slice through the spinal cord fast enough, and the brain can't tell the right hand to slit the throat of a hostage. I don't care how godlike you are. I sent her head sailing toward the pile of corpses, and her body slumped to the ground. Oberon was free and confused.
"Hey, what? I smell Atticus. Atticus, is that you?"
I didn't answer him. There was still another huntress to dispatch. Not caring about the noise I made, I chased after Artemis's head, snatched it up by the hair, and then chucked it directly at Diana. Her bow was fully raised and drawn now and swerving to shoot. She had to duck Artemis's head, but she straightened right back up to fire, correctly assuming that I was charging her. She was about to release, and I was about to drop and roll, when something whacked her hard in the back of the knees, and her shot went high and wide. It was Granuaile, of course, and she'd done me proud, taking advantage of the distraction I'd provided. All kinds of things can happen in a battle to make you freak out, I told her once. Freaking out over friends getting slagged, for example, is perfectly normal. Going Hulk because somebody ruined a picture or souvenir of your significant other, that's to be expected. And if someone returns from the dead to fight again, nobody will look down on you for losing a tolerable amount of your shit. But you always, always have to deal with the threat first and save the freaking out for later. Preferably when some decent alcohol is at hand to numb your noggin. Diana immediately rolled away when she hit the ground, and thus Granuaile's follow-up struck the earth with a dull thud. I wouldn't be able to get to the huntress before she regained her feet. She'd rolled with her bow and would be able to knock and fire another arrow at stupid speed if she made it. A blur in my vision announced that Oberon wanted her to stay down as much as I did. Granuaile must have refocused his attention. The huntress did manage to spring to her feet, only to be yanked back down as she reached for an arrow. I heard Oberon say,
"Got her left arm, you get the right."
Diana's attempt to free herself by clocking Oberon upside the head met severe resistance from Scowaja. Granuaile didn't miss this time, and her blow audibly snapped both bones in the goddess's forearm. The arm pressed into the turf, where Granuaile stomped on it. Diana shrieked and struggled to free herself, but I imagined that Granuaile and Oberon were both juiced on the earth's energy for extra strength, and she had no leverage. Before Diana could think of using her legs and possibly kicking Granuel off her arm, I decided to redirect her attention. I dropped my camouflage and said, "Well, hello there, Diana," as I strode into her view. Her eyes rounded, and her mouth stopped making noise and just hung open.
"It's Atticus. I knew it."
"Stay on her, buddy. Don't let go, okay?"
"I won't. She won't move."
"Thanks. We'll talk in a minute." I smiled at the shocked expression on Diana's face. Normally, I wouldn't behave this way, but something about the Romans brought it out in me. It probably had something to do with how they had helped to wipe out the druids. "You gave us quite the chase," I said. I twirled Fragora once in my hand and halted it abruptly, feigning surprise at an unexpected thought. "Oh, hold on. Did you think you were hunting us?" Her eyes narrowed and she took breath to speak, but she never got to say a word. I hacked off her head with one stroke and kicked it away from the body so she couldn't heal it back up.
"Whew!"
I shouted, allowing myself a fist pump. "That one's going on my highlight reel." Granuel dispelled her invisibility and Oberon's camouflage. Her knuckles were painfully white against the wood of Scalwija, and I couldn't tell by her face if she wanted to kiss me or kill me. "Right," I said. "You probably have questions."